This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Well, the prosecutors in this case should not be able to shout terrorism in a military courtroom when there is no evidence at all that Manning's act had any connection whatsoever to terrorism. There has been no evidence presented that Manning did any searches for Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. This figure who is a spokesperson for Al-Qaeda, Adam Gadan, who is in a propaganda video that has been entered into evidence. There's no evidence that he ever looked at Inspire magazine, which is an Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula magazine. And even though, you know, Al-Qaeda used this as propaganda, the releases of WikiLeaks, there is no strategic or tactical advantage that it can be seen that Al-Qaeda used to launch any attacks against the United States. And yet, after the fact, the prosecutors are going after Manning and trying to paint him as somebody who aided terrorism.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to continue this in a post-show conversation. We're going to post it online at democracynow.org. Kevin Gostela speaking to us from the Fort Meade parking lot, where Bradley Manning is on trial. He is a civil liberties blogger at Fire Dog Lake and has been tending Manning's trial from the beginning. We also want to thank Colonel Morris Davis for joining us. A retired Air Force colonel resigned as the former chief military prosecutor at Guantanamo Bay in 2007. He testified at the Manning trial Monday and Tuesday. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berker, Nafel Zaramante, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with our host, Lisa Loving. Today's guest is energy expert Steve Horn, and we'll talk about President Obama's climate action plan for cutting carbon pollution. Mr. Horn says it's a full-throttle endorsement of every aspect of fracking.
On Thursday, July 18th, from 5:30 to 7 p.m., KBOO will be broadcasting the first town hall meeting called by the nonprofit group Article 5 Convention for Our Children's Future on the issue of the national defense budget. Experts on the panel include Dr. Robert Pollan, Dr. Miriam Pemberton, and Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Once again, you can tune in on Thursday, July 18th from 5:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale. Full Circle accepts like-new natural fiber clothing, jewelry, and accessories for consignment or store credit. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont, and on the web at gazellenaturalfiberclothing.com or fullcircleresaleportland.com.
This KBOO program has also been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
Good morning. It is 8:05 a.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio, live progressive talk radio every weekday morning on KBOO Community Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Loving, and today is President Obama's climate action plan a full-throttle endorsement of fracking? And how is this going to impact our local communities? We have on the line Steve Horn. He's a blogger, a research guy for the DSmog blog. Steve, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Really glad to have you on the show. Steve, okay, you have been writing about this issue. You've been looking into this issue of shale, like oil from shale, the places that we're getting energy anymore. And listeners, Steve just recently wrote, President Obama announced his administration's climate action plan for cutting carbon pollution in his second term in the Oval Office at Georgetown University. And unfortunately, it's a full-throttle endorsement of every aspect of fracking and the global shale gas market. So my question is, how are our local communities going to be impacted by the corporate government partnership to build out what looks like an unsustainable energy future? I'm just putting that out. Steve Horn, talk about this issue. What is the shale oil? Isn't shale a rock?
Yes, so shale is a rock, and shale is a rock in which oil and gas can now be obtained via sophisticated technology called hydraulic fracturing, or more commonly known as fracking, and is made famous by Gasland 1, the film that came out in 2010. Now Gasland 2 is out, just came out yesterday, or sorry, 2 days ago on HBO. And basically, what fracking is and how it differs from conventional oil or gas drilling, in which you stick a rig downwards vertically and suck the oil or gas back up, not too far under the ground. It's just more like shallow deposits. Fracking is found in shale rock basins, basically where you have to tap down about a mile downwards and a mile outwards, more or less, vertically, then horizontally, tap into some extreme conditions, basically create an underground earthquake in which chemicals, lots of water, lots of sand to break open the fissures are used to, in a very sophisticated technology, suck the gas back up horizontally and upwards through the well, and hope that in the process that there's no failures in the well casing and that there's none of the methane, which is what the gas is, basically goes up, emits upwards into the water table that you go below, which has been a huge problem. Water contamination is probably why fracking became the most famous, although it's really not the only concern with fracking itself. As I've pointed out, there's lots of air problems with it, and also lots of climate change problems with it, which is, I think, the biggest concern above and beyond everything else, because, you know, that's the planet that we live on, and if it gets too hot, none of us can live on it. It will become uninhabitable. But fracking, when it was originally endorsed by the entire U.S. government and by President Obama, originally President Bush, basically as a bridge fuel to a cleaner energy future, you know, bridging away from coal and you know, going on to cleaner energy. But the problem with it is that it's not cleaner than coal. There's been studies that have come out that have said that fracking itself, when you look at the entire life cycle, is actually dirtier than coal because of fugitive methane emissions, that methane being a greenhouse gas is 21 times more potent than conventional carbon, which is emitted from coal. So there are lots of things to pick apart in the fracking boom, all kinds of geopolitical issues, all kinds of domestic energy issues, international energy issues. But I think the number one thing to remember is that the big, I guess, like if you want to say what the big lie was, is that it's a cleaner bridge to a cleaner future, when it's actually potentially a lot more disastrous than just conventional coal. And coal is no, I guess it's nothing great about coal either, considering all the problems that it causes, and especially with mountaintop removal and unconventional coal, because conventional coal is becoming much more depleted domestically. So they're going for coal in much more difficult areas to get, just like this gas. But I think overall, overarching thing here is that we're talking about a sphere of extreme energy extraction, whether it be tar sands, whether it be mountaintop removal for coal, whether it be fracking. We're talking about getting to the last reservoirs of this oil and gas, or going to extreme regions to get it, such as extreme dictatorships, like we're going to talk about later, Azerbaijan, mm-hmm. or talking about doing offshore drilling in places. No matter what the situation, we're talking about going to extreme lengths to get tap the last gas or oil that's left. And that's the other thing to keep in mind, is that this is completely unsustainable, especially at the rates at which it's being tapped.
Mm. And this is Wednesday Talk Radio on KBOO Community Radio. Listeners, Steve Horn, who we're with. Steve, where are you located?
I'm in Madison, Wisconsin.
Oh, say hi to Madison for us. We love Madison. Madison has an awesome community radio station as well. Steve, a couple things. So, listener, Steve just referenced Azerbaijan, and I went to this petrochemical industry, U.S.-Azerbaijan Friendship Conference. It was about a month ago or so. And now, this conference has been written about in multiple places about, you know, why it features something like 300 state legislators and members of Congress and other people from the United States who traveled there specifically to Baku, Azerbaijan, to meet with oil industry executives, movers and shakers in the petrochemical industry. And there were sessions. It was at this great big convention center. Azerbaijan is it's not a democratic country. I'm just going to come out and say it's ruled by a dictator. And so I went to this conference. It was sponsored by BP, just like every oil or petrochemical company you've ever heard of, in addition to the state oil company of Azerbaijan, and different regional oil interests. And this event, it rocked my world. It really did make me worry for the future. And because that's part of what it was about, was the future of sustainable energy and national security, basically. But what I took from it was that a lot of these issues are about the infrastructure, the energy infrastructure, as Mr. Horn talked about, global petrochemical issues. These different energy infrastructures are already stretching all over the planet like a web. And we're talking about, now Mr. Horn's talking about fracking, the kind of fuel that comes from fracking. Mr. Horn, is that a liquid fuel?
It is a liquid fuel,
all
yeah.
Right. So,
and it's the same as after it's extracted, same as conventional gas, but it takes a lot more effort to get it, and there's a lot more. I mean, it's just very extreme method of getting it, because the United States, I think, you know, the overarching premise of what we're talking about here is that this has become a geopolitical issue, and that's why the United States wants to become a big global supplier of gas. And Azerbaijan sits in this picture because the United States wants Azerbaijan's gas, and it doesn't want Russia to get Azerbaijan's gas. And, you know, because of these geopolitical issues of basically of empire and of, I don't really know how else to put it other than the United States wants to remain, you know, the predominant global power, it's going to go through hell and half fire to, you know, supply the spigot of gas in the world. But, you know, the problem is that Russia's gas is, I guess the United States' problem is that Russia's gas is a lot easier to get. Russia has conventional gas, doesn't have to do fracking to get it, and has a lot of it. The problem with fracking, the kind of an overarching problem of it that we can talk about, is that basically it has a diminishing return. So you frack a well one time, you get a certain amount in, then you go a second time and you get kind of a lesser amount. There's this thing called the drilling treadmill, in which, you know, you're running on the treadmill and you get less and less each time. And that's something that the industry doesn't really like to talk about, because it likes to say it has 100 years of gas.
That's exactly what the dictator said, 100 years. Yeah.
Exactly. That's a talking point that was created by the American Petroleum Institute, and also is touted by the American Natural Gas Alliance, ANGA. It's not true. There's lots of analysts who are actually just independent analysts who, you know, have geological backgrounds and have looked at the data and say that, you know, actually at best, the United States probably, especially at the rate at which they're drilling it, maybe have about 10 to 15 years left of shale gas, even though we're being told 100, which is very problematic, because lots of Wall Street money is being invested, lots of taxpayer money is being invested in this shale gas infrastructure. And you know, just as a parallel to, say, the housing boom, because right now we're talking about a fracking boom, if it goes bust, that means bailout, or that could mean energy crisis, even more importantly, because that could mean a lot of energy that we're talking about having here at home. A lot of people, there could be a gas crisis akin to the 1970s gas crisis. That's what there's a new book out about that by Bill Powers called Cold, Hungry, and in the Dark, and about the natural gas supply myth. And he's a guy who is actually an energy investor, but he looked at it critically and said, you know, at the rate it's being drilled, there's just not that much, especially the way it's being depleted. A lot of these shale basins are actually in terminal decline, even though we're being told that it's a boom. It was a boom, but it's not, you know, it's being tapped at such unsustainable rates for this geopolitical race that we could be in a lot of trouble. And it's not just it's for so many reasons, but I think still the overarching premise should be that the biggest problem is the ecological hazards and the climate hazards, which are never taken into account by the people that you dealt with in Azerbaijan.
No, and it was interesting because of all the people that were talking, people would give like a wink and a nod to climate change as if it were a joke that we didn't want to talk about. So we have a couple callers,
right.
But before we go there, there's a couple of the things I also want to put on the table, right? Okay, so when at this conference, it was all about LNG, okay? All these people were talking about pipelines here, pipelines there, tar sands, and where's that fuel going to go? And literally looking at like webs of liquid fuel pipelines stretching like literally all across the freaking globe. And one of the things that people were looking at that struck me, because on Monday, a runaway freight train loaded with crude oil exploded in Quebec, destroyed the town, and there's 40 people missing. So when we're talking about fuels and we're talking about shipping these fuels, the fracked fuel, right, that stuff, it's terrible for the environment. Check this out. It's also going to be shipped right through our neighborhoods, okay? They're basically looking at shipping all this stuff right through our neighborhoods, through the Columbia River, through wherever, right? And so it's actually going to pass by us and, who, you know, putting off the pollution as it goes. So it's coming and going. It's a danger to people who just happen to be there. And Mr. Horan, a couple weeks ago, we had the Columbia Riverkeeper, Dan Sears, on these airways. He talked about these issues of the coal shipments. Where we live in the Pacific Northwest, there's a big issue around the coal industries want to get explicit permission to start shipping coal through different avenues through our region to seaports, basically. And what I got from these seminars and these panels in Azerbaijan is, forget about coal. This is not about that at all. It's about the infrastructure that's going to allow these corporate interests, right? These petrochemical corporate interests to massively profit from these extractive industries that destroy our local environment. When it's taken out, it destroys our local environment. When it's shipped through, and then we send it off, and it has the biggest impact, right? The other big impact in global climate change. And before we go to the phone lines, Mr. Horan, I also wanted to say, when I was at this conference, what really struck me the most was this sense of entrenched corporate domination. We talk about, the government sector running the private sector, the corporate sector running the government. But we're looking at BP, all these massive corporate petrochemical companies that are hosting lawmakers, state lawmakers, and members of Congress who stood up in front of everyone and talked about the grand democratic traditions of Azerbaijan, the free country, which is a 100% mischaracterization of the Azerbaijan government, actually. And to see our own, state legislators in Washington State, one of the legislators went, no one from Oregon went, but from all over the country, there were hundreds of legislators that were all literally thrilled to be rubbing elbows with these VIPs. Another thing I want to bring up is freedom and money. So you hear these people talk about freedom isn't free. And so we're waging these wars and these soldiers are they're protecting our freedoms. But this is the thing. They're equating freedom with money. if you, whenever you hear now people say, you know, freedom ain't free and this war and the soldiers are keeping us free, swap out the word freedom for money and you start to see exactly what's going on. And the sustainability issue is super fascinating too. And I want to say, Mr. Horn, the dictator of Azerbaijan, Mr. Aliyev, he also... My issue with this was, well, how long will the Azerbaijan oil fields last? Because Azerbaijan is like their entire history of their entire country is intimately entwined with fuels. They have places in that country where flames spontaneously come out of the ground and have for 1,000 freaking years because there's just natural gas right there. And they have entire, that's why they call it the country of fire or something like that. So for them, these issues are part of their national identity in a fascinating way. And sustainability. I was going to say that the dictator also stood up and said he believed that Azerbaijan had 100 years worth of gas. And that it was for them to figure out what was going to be the new sustainable way of sustaining their country. But one of the issues that one person brought up, and this is the last point I'm going to make, and then you could talk a little and we can go to the phone lines, is someone stood up and said, what about wind energy? I'm so excited about it. And this man that was a representative from SOCOR, the state oil company of Azerbaijan, said, there's no infrastructure there. There's no infrastructure for solar. There's no real infrastructure for wind. It doesn't mean anything. It's just a toy. And that really, to me, that was a massive turning point because I realized while these extractive industries, these petrochemical corporations that really do dominate governments all over the world, while they are in charge of the infrastructure, they're going to make sure that there's no build out of solar or wind or wave energy or anything like that. And it's their power to do that. That's my last point. We have a couple callers, Mr. Horn. Did you want to respond to any of that?
I'll respond to a few of those things.
Blurt it out there. Go ahead.
Sure. Yes, you brought up a lot of important points. And the first one, I'll just start at the top, the train wreck in Quebec. That was actually from oil that was fracked from the Bakken Shale in North Dakota. That's important to note because there's lots of questions that need to be asked about that haven't been answered. It's too soon, I think, and that people don't even know. I mean, we don't even know how many people passed away or
boggles the mind.
The damage.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the pictures, look at the photos, look at the video, it's horrifying. But just want to note that that was fracked oil from the Bakken Shale, which is predominantly in North Dakota, and that's the biggest oil, shale oil basin in the United States, one of the biggest in the world, and you can actually see the Bakken Shale from outer space, from satellites, the lights on, because there's so much activity there. And that train was carrying over 2 million gallons of shale oil, 2.1 million, I think, to be exact, and on 72 train cars, which is just an extreme amount. It's something like 50,000 barrels of oil, quite a big shipment. And besides this train wreck, there's been tons of spills of pipelines, leaks, explosions of fracked gas and oil pipelines, plus tar sands pipelines. Just look at what happened in Mayflower, Arkansas earlier this year, in which basically this small city 30 minutes away from Little Rock, Arkansas is basically, doused right now in tar sands oil. And there's tons of contaminants in the air, toxic chemical contaminants in the air. So we're talking about very extreme amounts of oil and gas that are being shipped either by pipelines, aging pipeline infrastructure, especially in the case of Mayflower, Arkansas, or
freight train.
Freight trains that are not meant, and first of all, trains that aren't meant to carry this much oil, but also train lines that aren't meant to carry this heavy of weight of things. I think that the prominent thing to look at is they were trying to move as much as they can as quickly as possible to make as much money as quickly as possible.
That's really what it's about.
Freedom thing.
That's really what it's about.
Yeah. And then, so that's Quebec, and that's the connection to fracking. But there's also, I think, even just as importantly as what you talked about with Azerbaijan and the various power players who were there. And just to be specific about who was there, Jim Messina, Obama, one of Obama's top aides, was there. His former spokesperson, Robert Gibbs, was there. His former campaign higher up, David Pluoff, was there. I think Jill Biden was there, Joe Biden's wife. Mm-hmm. The head of Stratfor was there, George Friedman, and tons of other power players. Azerbaijan, as noted in a December 2012 Senate Foreign Relations report, is seen as the anchor of the global gas market for the United States strategic planners. And on top of the U.S. being a, they want to make the U.S. an export zone for fracked gas on the global market, they want to make sure that as much gas as possible is sucked away from Azerbaijan westward and not eastward towards Russia. And while all this is happening, and you know, not long after your conference happened, in Russia there was a big conference for the Gas Exporting Countries Forum, the GCEF, GCEF. And those countries are looking to create a counter to the, what the United States is doing. When you look at this all in total, you're just talking about global ecological destruction. But it's interesting, the geopolitics of it all. These countries, you know, it's basically Russia, Iran, Bolivia, Venezuela, Ecuador, a lot of the countries that Edward Snowden's considering going to, when we're talking about the geopolitics of his asylum decision, is actually roped right into the geopolitics of energy. And this GCF is basically, they're looking to make like an OPEC for gas exporting countries to counter what's happening in the United States with gas in the export markets. And that goes into coal exports that you're talking about. And also, gas exports is an issue not only, you know, gas and coal are both issues in Oregon where you are right now. Yeah. So you talked about the coal already, but
a new LNG terminal permit has been applied for as of 2 weeks ago, and we beat back one like 7 years ago. And part of the reason that people got so up in arms about having an LNG terminal was what the possibility if it exploded. You know, when people looked at the dimensions of it, it could have been like a mushroom cloud. That's how big, that's how much fuel would have gone up.
Yeah, and the guy, I mean, the guy you mentioned before, Dan Sirius of Columbia Riverkeeper, has been doing a lot of work on this too, the Jordan Cove LNG terminal. But that would involve sucking gas fracked from, you know, basically from the west, I think like mostly from Colorado, or you know, maybe in the future in California, in the Monterey Shale or the Niobrara Shale, as I talked about in Colorado. We're talking about piping that gas outwards through Oregon, just like through the mountains and through various pristine waterways of Oregon, and then, you know, shipping it westward towards Coos Bay, Oregon, right, the Jordan Cove LNG terminal, where it would be exported predominantly to Asia because it's on the West Coast. Also, one more note about these LNG terminals, that's that earlier this year, the second ever export terminal was approved by the Obama administration, the Freeport LNG terminal down in Freeport, Texas, close to Sabine Pass, where the first terminal was ever approved in Louisiana, that's owned by Cheniere. So we're talking about you know, the Congress itself, even today, just released a letter to talk about expediting all the terminals that are up for proposal for exports for gas, talking about expediting all their applications for the Department of Energy. But I think 23 senators signed on to a letter in a bipartisan fashion telling the DOE to expedite that decision. That's the second letter this year in which they've done that. So we're talking about a lot of money flowing into these congressmen to basically be servants of the oil and gas industry, as direct parallel to what happened to Azerbaijan. The same thing, these diplomats and congressmen and various players all in service to big oil. And you know, it's a big global industry, as you noted, with a lot of power and a lot of politicians more than willing to serve their interests.
And it's really key, too, and we're going to go to the phone lines in just a second, but it's really key, too, that a lot of these state legislators are invited, because the state legislators, you know, they're people who already have a job, people who already have a career. So it's like all these states, we all have citizen legislatures. And I love our state legislators in Oregon. We have some of the best anywhere, and there's wonderful ones in Washington, too. I do want to say, talking about a group of people that's not entirely socially sophisticated, though. So, I mean, hundreds of these state legislators, they don't have a clue where Azerbaijan is. They don't have any idea what shale oil gas is. Seriously. And people are invited to go over there, and their heads are filled with this rainbows and unicorns, right? No talk of conservation whatsoever. No talk of environmentalism. In fact, the consumption is actively encouraged. It's good for you to burn as much gas as possible. So you have these, I'm just going to put this out, really unsophisticated people from, you know, all over the country, actually. There were a lot of people from Tennessee, I want to say Virginia, Texas. There were a bunch of people in my group from Wyoming, Utah, Arizona. Wonderful people, Democrats and Republicans. And so when these big powers reach out to these basically underappreciated state-level lawmakers, what they're doing, they are really laying out a major infrastructure for how they're really going to make this stuff actually happen. And that, to me, I'm seeing all these stories about in Washington State, was this a junket? Did it actually have value? It did, for all the reasons that kind of the media doesn't understand or necessarily deal with. So we should go to the phone lines. We've got some very patient people waiting to talk.
Great.
We got Randy on the phone. What's going on, Randy?
Well, I guess I'm too unsophisticated to be a progressive.
Nah. Why, are you a lawmaker?
I'm just a very private citizen. I have no stake in any of this, but I would like to say, since I listen to all sides, I am informed that solar, wind, et cetera, is economically unfeasible. And I'll ask again. I asked, I think, a week or two ago, is there anything about natural resources exploitation that the progressive left doesn't oppose? I didn't get an answer last time.
Okay. All right, Randy, thanks. We're going to chew on that one a little bit. So Randy wants to, if I'm understanding that right, Randy wants to, he wants to know if there's anything that's like an extractive industry that the left doesn't oppose. And I do want to say, Randy, actually, when it comes to industries like that, I think that the big one that the left and parts of the right really embrace is like cannabis production. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's like the resources that come with a different kind of industry that's been massively outlawed. I'm just putting that out. But oil frack, you know, this could be an okay time, Mr. Horn.
Yeah, that's a good question, actually.
So,
a fair one.
Steve Horn, what do you think about that? Go ahead.
Yeah. So that was a two-part question. The first one was the feasibility of
solar and wind.
Renewable. Yeah, and there are, you know, I don't want to discount these serious questions about solar and wind. And one of my favorite books written by, I think, more of a guy more on the left is by Ozzie Zenner. It's called Green Illusions, and it's about some of the serious problems, including climate change problems, that come with producing solar energy and producing wind that people don't like to talk about, because a lot of these energies are big-time. They're not alternative energies, as the PR spin machines say. They are derivatives. They're derived still from fossil fuels. A lot of infrastructure that has to be, you know, come up with to create solar panels either comes from fossil fuels or comes from rare earth minerals mining in China, for example. With wind, it's the same thing. Some of the parts are derived both from fossil fuels and from rare earth minerals, but also, importantly, with wind, there has to be generators next to them at all times running to keep the wind running, because wind is a finite kind of resource. The wind's not always blowing fast enough, and it's kind of an inconvenient thing with these wind turbines is that it does need to be something running concurrently with it. And so the question is really not, to me, about one versus the other. The question is about a more sustainable economy that isn't just Wall Street dictating how much energy is produced, but based on big hedge funds that are making bets on how much oil is under the ground and how much they want to pull out. Because the elephant in the room for all of this is still runaway climate change and the problem of the methane gun, or enough methane in the air that we create a methane feedback loop, and as the methane feedback loop starts going, the temperature rises more and more and the Arctic melts away, and we're talking about potentially 6 degrees Celsius or more of heating on planet Earth, which is just basically an unsustainable planet for humans to live on. And I don't say this in alarmist, but I do say this as to answer the second question. And the left really should be concerned with all these questions, and they really should oppose projects that are going to lead to these consequences, because there's going to be large human suffering on planet Earth. And
already is, too,
There already is. And we're talking about global food shortages, we're talking about crop failures, we're talking about water shortages. And, the left needs to be really concerned with this. And I don't blame the left at all for opposing most extractive processes, I think that the left really should be looking at overall strategic planning to create a sustainable planet, or else we're in a lot of trouble. And we're already, if not at the tipping point, very close to it. If, you know, and if we keep, you know, this Azerbaijan junket was not encouraging, and these various legislative proposals are not encouraging for a sustainable planet. So I do think that, you know, the left as a whole does need to be concerned about these things and looking at an overall picture. But I think the left is also wrong in just saying, oh, well, we can have our cake and eat it too, and, you know, everything will be fine, the economic system's fine, and we can just switch to wind and solar. It's more, it's much more complex than that. So
right.
I think that that was a really good question.
Yeah, Randy. And so, Randy, just to put it on a bumper sticker, kind of, I guess what I... My sense, and I'm remembering how we answered this question that you brought up a couple weeks ago, is that I'm not sure, I understand why you're asking that question. Does the left support any extractive industry? But I personally don't think that's the right question to be asking. I think that, you know, people who are on the political left are literally looking at finding a balance in what's taking place. But Randy, I do want to say this, hot air, okay? I would totally support an extracted industry around hot air. I'm putting that out, set it up in D.C., right inside the Beltway. I mean, that thing could be revolutionary. And I feel like I heard Mr. Horn say the phrase methane feedback loop. It's freaking me out. Let's go back to the phone lines. We've got Joanne on the phone. Joanne, what's going on?
Boy, the energy on this program is overwhelming. I don't know if I can speak. I've been waiting so long, too. But anyway, I realize I don't know much about technology, et cetera, but I thought maybe your guest could give me some information. I've been experiencing in my apartment for a while rumblings and vibrations and that, and I think it has to do to several reasons. And one of them, I think, is the cell phone towers and Comcast crap on top of my on top of the building. I happen to live on the first floor, and I'm also wondering about, you know, could it be, even though it could be many things, radon or something coming up from the ground, meeting with this low or high frequency in my apartment, wherever the hell else is going on in it. But anyway, I will go and see and listen to your program. Goodbye.
Right. Thanks for calling, Joanne. And Joanne brings up interesting points always as well. And I actually think that a lot of us know more about energy than we realize. We just don't think about it, right? In the United States, specifically in many parts of the United States, we just don't think about it. And so as Joanne is there in her first floor apartment, I think in a large building, you could very well be affected by radon. I don't know that radon would make a noise. And so as far as the rumblings in the apartment, I'm not sure what that's about. But cell phone towers on top, I'm not sure the noise that those make. And we should do an entire show just about that. The Magical Engineering Pixie says that the cell phone towers require air conditioners. Is that what you're saying? And that's what makes the lumpy noise. Anyway, we should do an entire story, an entire show just about radio waves and cell phone towers. But one of the things that struck me, Joanne, and you kind of touched on this in a way, but not really, is how implicit we all are in this United States with this energy grid. And when Joanne said the energy is intense, I saw what you did there. Anyway, that was funny. But Joanne, I think we should do an entire show about that. And Mr. Horn, again, I think one reason why in the United States, where actually I think the United States is one of the largest producers of fuel in the entire world. Isn't that true? And we consume a lot of it, too. And a lot of our standard of living is tied up in that.
Yeah, I mean, the United States has for the first time ever become, exported more oil and gas than it did imported in 2012, according to the EIA, the Energy Information Agency. But and also, I mean, I don't really feel capable of answering that question about radon, but I will say that it's an interesting just to even think about a cell phone, because I pointed out the rare earth minerals earlier on the other question, and that's one of the issues actually with with cell phones and computers and a lot of things that we take for granted is the footprint of manufacturing these devices, these techno gadgets that we all use, is that, you know, it comes with extreme ecological costs, especially in Central Africa or even in the area that you were, not in Azerbaijan in particular, but especially in Kazakhstan, where there's a lot of rare earth minerals, China too. where, you know, you need these tough to mine minerals to put into cell phones to make them work. So, and with that comes also, you know, probably a lot of the things that were highlighted by the caller that I just don't know a lot about. Mm-hmm. That's the human impacts of what does it mean to talk on a cell phone for 30 years of your life? Does that mean cancer? Does that mean, what does it mean? There's a lot of questions to be asked.
Yeah,
so I think that there's all types of interesting questions to be asked about the kind of the Frankenstein we've created with our fascination with technology and techno fixes and all everything related to that.
It's true. And this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. We are live on the phone with Steve Horn. He's a research associate for the DSmog blog, and he's recently been writing about Obama's climate action plan, a full-throttle endorsement of fracking. You know, we have a couple callers on the line. Fracking, it's like I saw that movie come out. I was like, wow, fracking. And I'm thinking, places where people produce oil or energy in the United States, they must be far away. No, they're not. And they're all going to be shipped right through our neighborhoods, dude. That's an issue for us right here, right now. So let's go back to the phone lines. We got Steve on the phone. Steve, what's going on?
Oh, hi. I wanted to answer a couple of things that Randy said about the left. Was it Judy Barry was working with mill workers and environmentalists when she was dynamited? And Joseph Bauer was a supervisor, and he was an environmentalist supervisor in Trinity County, Northern California. And there's a Jippo logger who was also working with the environmentalists. And they had the plan. They wanted the Forest Service to make a ruling that if you cut a log in a county, it was milled there. And that was fought by the mills. And subsequently, the mills are closed down, and those towns are dying. So much for sustainability. But these were leftists working with mill workers and loggers. When in the 60s, the Sierra Club wanted to recruit the chief forester for Sierra Pacific because of his sustainable logging practices. And the same was done by on the coast with, I forgot the company, it's out of Scotia. It was taken over by Milliken on a junk bond deal. And they were doing sustainable logging in the redwoods, and they were completely trashed in order to make short-term profits. And the mill town closed down. Scotia closed down. I think somebody bought it again and opened it up again as, for whatever reason. But as far as the loggers and mill workers went, that town and that industry, you know, bankrupted itself.
Mm-hmm.
There are, as far as sustainability, the number one solar nation, solar power nation in the world is sunny Germany. And I remember back when they came out with LEDs, this was being mocked as being useless, that all these alternative energy things were useless. They were like LEDs. You couldn't do anything useful with them. And now LEDs have replaced all the headlamps in cars. There's no will to change any of these things. It's not that the left is not saying anything sustainable. It means how can you make the way we are going sustainable, which it isn't. It's suicidal. And rather than face this, rather than face the kind of costs that this technological world that we're creating is doing, the empire that it's necessary to sustain it, we're saying, what can we do to keep this going? And there's no answer to that. The left can't answer that because it needs to change.
Yeah. It's a great point, Steve. And the other thing that strikes me is that when I was a little girl, conservatives were into saving stuff. When I was a little girl in the 60s, right, at conservatives, Republicans, they wanted not to spend all the money. They wanted not to use up all the stuff. It's like conservative meant something. But here in this discussion, there's no talk of conservation, no talk of, like we were already saying, what is sustainability? Like, what if we just sell all the energy from out of the United States? What if we thought we needed it 10 years from now or whatever? It's like this issue of just reasonableness.
Right. When is it enough? And there's no satisfaction to say, well, this is enough. It's a wrong question. It's not asked. And when I say the left, and I mention the Sierra Club, I mean a lot of people, in the environmental movement are just groaning and rolling their eyes, calling that left. And yet that's considered far left by a lot of the right wingers that I know. That's considered extreme.
Yeah.
Which it isn't.
It's a spectrum. Anyway, all right. Thank you, Steve. Thanks a lot for calling. Steve brought up some awesome points. And I, you know, it's funny that you said that because I forgot about Judy Berry and the mill workers when she was assassinated, basically. Yeah, she was bringing the mill workers together with the community organizers. And anyway, Randy asked that question, my first thought, like, does the left support any extractive industries? I was thinking, I think that there's some sustainable logging practices that came under that. But I still, that is a fascinating question. What extractive industries does the left support? Because I met on this trip to Azerbaijan a lot of people from Wyoming, and there's huge mines in Wyoming, and I think the mines are unionized, and so those politics become very confusing, you know, left, right. And they also talked about what the mines in Wyoming did to the education system, because so many young males who were teenagers dropped out of school to get jobs in those mines in Wyoming, and their careers were very short, like less than 10 years, and then they get out of the mines, their health is broken, and they can't read. They have no high school diploma or anything. So, you know, when we talk about extractive industries, I want to put this out there. Human beings are an extractive industry in our culture and probably all over the world. And I think that people on the left support human beings. I don't know. That's just me. I'm thinking out loud. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. We're talking about Obama's climate action plan, a full throttle endorsement of fracking. How does that impact our local communities? We're live on the phone with Steve Horn. He's a research associate for the DSmog blog. You've got to check out the DSmog blog, by the way. I'd never heard of it before, Steve. And when I went there, it was like, God, all these issues I've been following, and I have to go to all these different places to check them out. They were all there right on that blog.
Thanks. Yeah, I appreciate it. So, yeah, I, you know, another thing I want to just talk a little bit more about the Obama plan itself, just to get the nuts and bolts down, because okay. Then I think that would connect some of the dots, you know, the stuff we've been talking about with Azerbaijan and, you know, the global shale game, the global gas market. And that's that. When I talk about all, he endorsed all aspects of fracking. That means that not only did he, I mean, I do want to say he never strategically, this is a very smart PR move on his part, on his team's part, never used the word fracking. He used the term clean burning natural gas, which is
exactly what Sarah Palin said, clean green natural gas. And we went, what?
Exactly.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
This is an industry, this is a comfortable industry talking point. It's basically complete myth, but except for, you know, it's not, I mean, I shouldn't say it's a complete myth. It has some truth in it, and that's that at the power plant itself, it burns more cleanly than coal. But, you know, that doesn't take into account the life cycle I talked about earlier, as highlighted by that May 2011 Cornell University study that said that as a life cycle, shale gas is actually dirtier than coal if you look at the entirety of it, which is really important because then it really disproves the clean burning natural gas theory. But, you know, besides this endorsement of clean burning natural gas, as he put it, that he also, maybe not so much in the speech, but the speech was actually about his climate plan, which is a 20-page document that I feel like not enough people read and more people pay attention to the speech, the nice-sounding speech. The plan itself talked about creating a natural gas vehicles market, especially with trucks, 18-wheelers, which is mostly controlled by tycoon T. Boone Pickens, which a lot of the listeners may have heard of. He funded the 2004 Swift Boat campaign against John Kerry in support of George W. Bush for president, and you know, was one of the main funders of that campaign, that smear campaign of John Kerry, who's now the Secretary of State of the United States. And that leads into my third point, and that's actually pertaining directly to John Kerry, and that's that the speech also endorsed creating an export market for U.S. shale gas, which is supported big time by his head of the Department of Energy, Ernest Moniz, who has a background in fracademia, as I call it. He used to be at MIT, where he took a lot of money from the oil and gas industry and did a lot of studies of the industry sites that were funded directly, you know, by the likes of BP. For example, the Future of Natural Gas is a study that he co-authored, which is cited by the industry all the time about how much gas there is under the ground and climate impacts and all of that. So then we're creating an export market, which Moniz will oversee as the head of the DOE. He was named the head of the DOE a couple months ago. And then lastly, we're talking about in the climate plan, the United States serving as a missionary force of sorts through the Department of State led by John Kerry, in which the United States will go around the world and show other countries how to do fracking and with best practices, as I like to say. And
because
means,
it's interesting, a lot of places are saying, well, we have shale. We don't know how to get the gas out
and
of it.
Don't.
But we know we will eventually. A lot of companies are coming right out and saying that already.
Right. So they'll partner up with the United States. And the same thing that's happened in the United States will happen globally, unfortunately. And that's, we're talking about a lot of water contamination, air contamination, and destruction of ecosystem and of communities. And this will be done under the auspices of what they're now calling the Unconventional Gas Technical Engagement Program, which used to go by the name of the Global Shale Gas Initiative, and that's being run under the State Department. It'd be really interesting to, if there's ever another WikiLeaks document down, to see what kind of strangleholds the United States is putting other countries under to take part in this initiative. But we'll see. And you know, this is all part of Obama's climate action plan, which, in my opinion, is a plan for destruction, if this is, even if only this fracking part is carried on. There's other parts that were troubling, too. But
okay. Steve Horn, here's the other thing I want to, and we've got a couple of callers on the line. When I just want to, one of the biggest takeaways I had from this really scary conference was, when we talk about the U.S. government, we talk about what Obama's doing. You might as well just swap out his name and put in BP or put in Shell Oil. I mean, I honestly, truly, genuinely believe that these corporate interests are really drawing that up, and they're really playing everyone in the government like puppets. And let's rush to the phone lines. We've got a couple people. We've got Marie on the phone. Marie, what do you think?
Yes, good morning. And thank you very much, guest speaker, on the gas issue. So I want to just do a few points, and I'll try really hard to be succinct. And, of course, the movie Gaslands changed my life. It's a huge eye-opener. I want to reiterate some of the things you said, Gift, but one of my ideas is that I have a certificate as a deaconess, and my dream and hope and my vision is that every single church to be showing that movie Gaslands. It is necessary for us to know the truth. It's happening in many states, I think something like 15 states. How many states is it that they're doing fracking right now?
You know, I think that there's a possibility of fracking in 32 states. At least that's what the shale, if you look at a map, the shale covers over 32 states. But every state's implicated in the infrastructure one way or another.
Because they're going to ship that stuff. They have to ship it. They're trying to get it literally like a web everywhere. Putting that out. Anyway, Marie, so, and you heard Mr. Horn say that Gaslands 2 just came out, right? The sequel
came out this week on HBO.
And Marie, I agree with you. I think that every church, people should be checking that movie out. And Marie, thank you. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you.
And let's go to the next caller. We got Jack on the phone. Jack, what's going on?
I want to put into the conversation the necessity to address the issue of third world development, and that the sophisticated solar plans that are going forward in Germany, whether or not they will save the third world, I don't know if there's any will to invest in that way, but you know, in the third world, people die daily, many thousands of underdevelopment, and they need development, they need energy, and if it can't be provided affordably, they continue to die. So if left progressives, who presumably care about humanity, want to move forward with some kind of program, that issue has to be addressed.
All right, Jack. Thanks a lot. Jack is bringing up a super-duper important point. And looking at third world development, underdeveloped countries, and now, Mr. Horn, we're beginning to run out of show. We've got 4 minutes left. Jack brought this up. What about poor people around the world? Can the left?
That's a good question.
I know.
Yeah, I can answer that one.
There you go. Thanks a lot. And this will probably be our last great big point. Go.
Sure. Yeah. So the question did have some underlying sort of, I would say, beliefs that are slightly wrong and slightly right at the same time, and that's that you know, there is underdevelopment in the what he referred to as the third world, I actually would refer to as the global south. And that's an area of the world that actually does have a lot of development of energy infrastructure. If you look at Africa right now, if you look at Central Asia right now, where you just went to Azerbaijan, this is all considered the developing world. And it's being developed, but it's not being developed on behalf of the people there. It's being developed on behalf of
the
global powers, the global north. And that's to turn these countries into huge export markets so that the United States, China, Russia, the BRICS, Brazil, India, all these powerful countries are using them as resource colonies, in which they are going into these countries or continents such as Africa and not only plundering the energy infrastructure, but also plundering the food systems, the seeds, the
people.
All in the name of development, all in the name of humanitarian uplift. But it's all a mask for an exploitative regime for empire. And there's a concept called the underdevelopment of development that, a lot of people said, look, in the name of development, we're not developing these countries at all. We're just using them for exploitation. I think that's what's really happening. I think that we need to look through the smokescreen of them. That just happened. One more point I want to make is Obama just went to Africa doing about the same thing. We talked about developing infrastructure in Africa, but, who's leading the charge there? It's General Electric, and it's not about helping the people of Africa. It's about these big multinational corporations going into Africa in the name of doing that, and then sucking out the resources, sucking them dry, and then leaving, and then the people there are still suffering. So I think we need to look at things more critically than just humanitarian uplift, as the World Bank likes to say, and look at what's really happening.
It's true, Jack. So your vision is beautiful in how to literally share the wealth or something like that. If I don't know what the progressive left can do to impact the attitude of the corporate sector as far as petrochemical development goes, I was at this conference, dude. I lost hope. I'm not lying to you. I was horrified by it. And I don't know what we can do to go up against all these people. But I do know in our local communities, we have significant victories. Here in Oregon, activists beat back the old LNG pipeline bid a few years ago. So the best I can do is hope that when people organize to try to energize our own communities and control what happens in our own communities, sometimes we have victories. So Steve Horn, we're running out of show. How do people find out more about your work, Steve Horn?
Thanks for having me. And I think the best way is to go to DSmog blog. I try to write almost daily or every other day. And then on top of that, I also write for other publications like Truth Out, Counterpunch, Mint Press News, others, and mostly about energy and energy geopolitics.
Awesome, so. Steve. I'm going to have to talk with you more later. And thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
That's it for our show. Thanks to our guest, Steve Horn. Check him out on the web at dsmogblog.com. Special thanks to engineer Steve Nasser and Sky the Studio Dog. This show will be podcast on KBOO.fm by the end of today. Grab that link. Share it with your friends and family. I'm Lisa Loving. Follow me on Twitter for more news and information about the topics we discuss on this show. Theme music by the March 4th Marching Band. You know they're going to be at the Oregon Country Fair this weekend. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for Noam Chomsky and David Barsamyan.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. The time is 8:59.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KABU, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
Take 6.
Dr. Zahm's Stereo Obscura and A Different Nature present the film Theremin, An Electronic Odyssey for this month's KABU Night at the Clinton Street Theater. The documentary tells the story of Leon Theremin, his invention of the only instrument you play without touching it, and its use in Hollywood films and rock music. The film will be showing 7 p.m. Thursday night, July 11th, at the Clinton Street Theater, corner of Southeast 26th and Clinton, and all proceeds will benefit
KBOO Portland.
On Friday, July 19th, from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., tune in for KBOO's one-day flash drive fundraiser, a day filled with news and music from the equator to Antarctica.
Lecture topics will include climate change, gay rights, and an overview of African land grabs. Don't miss out on the chance to explore underrepresented music and news from across the Southern Hemisphere on July 19th, from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m.
It's 9 o'clock straight up, and you are listening to KBOO Portland. At 9 o'clock, hear a recently recorded interview with noted scholar and author Noam Chomsky, talking about state spying and other matters, with host David Barsamian. At 10 o'clock, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, a look at the connections between yesterday's massive car bombing in Beirut, Lebanon, and the civil war in Syria, and a report on the fight for freedom of press at the Bradley Manning trial. And at 11 on the Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen and guest Jim Gilbert discuss how to prune your home orchard. And the plant of the month is parsnips. Coming up now, on June 20th, alternative radio host David Barsamian sat down with legendary MIT professor and peace and justice activist Noam Chomsky.